All right, on that basis, then, we're ready for argument in Lafarge Construction.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Karen Treese, registration number 11610, appearing on behalf of Lafarge, an insurance company of the state of Pennsylvania. In order to ensure that justice is done, there's two very important points I need to make today. First of all, it is well settled law that unexplained falls are not compensable in workers' compensation unless the person is placed in a position of special hazard or risk, such as being at height.
Be in this case that the forklift or the roller he was operating would constitute such a risk.
I would agree if he were on it, but there's no evidence he was on it contained in the record.
As I read the record, there was testimony at the hearing by the claimant that the last thing he remembers is parking his roller when he drove over by his truck, and he doesn't remember anything happening after that. I think there was also testimony by his coworker when he found him on the ground. He came up to him, and the coworker testified that he told him he didn't recall what had happened. So doesn't that create a conflict in testimony?
There's no dispute, and the court has found in several of his findings that the claimant has no recollection of the event and no recollection of even the day 6 weeks later. So there is no dispute that the court in finding number three found that the claimant told his supervisor at the end of the day that he had put his vest in his lunchbox in his truck and was returning to the roller when he passed out. Finding number four also indicates that he reported to the emergency room and this was the next day, that he had been operating heavy machinery and he had gotten off, walked to his truck, and fell to the ground. We do not have him ever getting back on the roller.
But he's. My concern is why we. Are you asking us to disregard evidence as supporting the finding where there is evidence that he doesn't remember anything happening after he. He does not recall that he got off the roller? I mean, there's one set of, I realize they're inconsistent statements, but there is testimony that he does not recall getting off
the roller. He doesn't recall any of the events of that day, according to the findings of the court.
Well, then, but you're attributing statements that he made about what happened then.
Well, immediately that day, he did apparently tell not only the supervisor and the emergency personnel that he had gotten off and he had gone, put the lunchbox and the vest in his vehicle, his pickup, and was walking back to the truck.
So there is conflicting testimony.
So we don't have any conflicting testimony.
Right.
We've got a guy that has no recollection.
It's your position there's no conflicting
testimony. There's no conflicting testimony. He's on the ground. That's the only evidence that we have. We don't have him on his roller.
Don't you also have evidence from which a reasonable person can conclude? And, you know, I might not have drawn that conclusion, that the circumstances are such that he fell from a greater height than his shoe tops.
I disagree. The court in finding number 11 surmises that he fell off the roller. We don't know that. We don't know. He did this based on two different things. The finding that his radio was approximately 10 feet from him and his hard hat was approximately 5 feet from him. We do not know how it is that those items happened to be that much farther away from him. We don't know whether he threw them there. We don't know whether he was assaulted. We don't know anything as to why they're there. They're unexplained as to why they're in the locations that they're in. We also don't. The other thing that the court relied on is the court found that it was inconsistent with a drop from a ground that they would be that much farther. But this is a freshly paved surface, and the only other thing that the court relies on is that he has a bloody lip and a little bump on the back of his head. And the court jumps to the conclusion that he hit his lip on the roller and then he hit the back of his head. Now, if he fell 5 feet to the ground, one would expect much more in the way of abrasions, which were not seen in the emergency room, maybe even fractures. One we don't know that he hit his lip first and then his head. We don't know what he struck. We don't know whether he bit his lip. There's no evidence as to those things. What we do know, though, is that he had obviously taken his seatbelt off, and he obviously wasn't operating the thing. We don't know if he's... We do have some evidence that he's on the ground. We don't have any evidence that he's getting off. But if he was getting off, because he's not wearing a seatbelt, if he was wearing a seatbelt, he couldn't have fallen off. We don't know how close he is to the ground. Maybe he's got one foot on the ground. Maybe he's made it all the way down. We don't know that he's above the ground. We don't know. There's no evidence. There's no blood on the roller. You know, we don't know. And how can we surmise that someone could strike their lip with so much force, only so much force, that he only gets a bloody lip, nothing else, and then he falls back with a sufficient force that he goes forward, and then it causes him to reverse direction and fall backwards on his head? Makes no sense.
Well, let me spin that question around. If he only fell from his standing position, how could he simultaneously injure the front of his face and the back of his head?
Easily. If you fall and you're unconscious, then you can hit your head and bite your lip.
Do the hospital records identify it?
The hospital records don't even reflect a bloody lip. The only thing the hospital records reflect is a bump on the back of his head, and he's assessed with syncope or passing out. That's the only thing the hospital records show. So, it was nothing more than rank speculation for the court to find that he fell off his roller when we don't know where he was. We do know that in Finn, the case substantially similar to this, the claimant was found at his workplace with a skull fracture, abrasions, bruising of his eyes and forearms, and he didn't know what happened to him. And he surmised that he had been struck by a forklift. And the court found that the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur does not apply to workers' compensation. Claimant must make his burden of proof to show that there's some connection with the workplace. And that, like here, where claimant failed to show how he had received his skull fracture and other injuries in Finn, claimant can't show here how he got his bruise on the back of his head or the bloody lip. The emergency room checked all over his body and found no other injuries at the emergency room. Substantial evidence test permits the court to vacate grossly mistaken orders or orders which the great weight of evidence or even overwhelming evidence supports contrary conclusions. Evidence is not substantial if it's overwhelmed by other evidence or is a mere conclusion. It must be more than a mere scintilla. We don't have any evidence to show where he was at the time of his fall. And citing the Wecker versus TBL excavating for the substantial evidence test. Now, I'd like to address the other important point, that the issue of waiver of right of first selection was not before the court. In fact, the ALJ had no jurisdiction to decide this issue. The parties stipulated that Concentra was the authorized treating physician. Once that stipulation was made, the employee cannot change physicians of his own accord. He can ask permission to change physicians from the insurance company. He can prospectively get a court order of a change of physicians, but that's after a hearing. And up until that point in time, the original designated physician is the designated physician. You can't reach the issue of waiver of the right of first selection when the parties had already stipulated that Concentra had been authorized. At the hearing, when the court first called up this case, the court asked what the issues were. And opposing counsel, Ms. Tolberg, indicated the issues for hearing were compensability, medical benefits, average weekly wage, and medical bills if appropriate, and 1 week of temporary disability benefits. The court then asked what the outstanding bills were, to which she responded that she didn't have any. The reason the ALJ asked this is because if he doesn't order specific benefits be ordered paid, whether it be medical benefits, specific bills, or temporary disability benefits, then the order is not a final order for purposes of appeal. It's interlocutory for a time. Ms. Tolbert at that point went on to advise the court that the employer did send the claimant to Concentra. Consequently, we did not litigate that issue. At the conclusion of the hearing, after the parties had rested, the court asked whether there was an agreement as to authorized treating physician. Ms. Tolbert said, I said Concentra. Ms. Tolbert said, that's fine. The court said, okay, that's stipulated. So then the court asked if there was an agreement as to Dr. Keith, the personal physician of the claimant. The court cannot wait until after the close of the evidence to ask if there is an issue of whether Dr. Keith was authorized. When the issue of medical benefits was raised on the application for hearing and at the beginning of the hearing, all that means is the court is going to enter an award, if compensable, that's an open-ended award that says, respondents will pay for reasonable and necessary and related medical benefits. If they can't order a specific bill, that's what the order says. The issue of Dr. Keefe's authorization was not at issue when we tried this case.
Okay, are you saying that the hearing officer or ALJ did not have to resolve this issue in order to get Dr. Keefe's bills paid, or are you saying that the payment of Dr. Keefe's bills wouldn't even be decided until a subsequent proceeding?
It wouldn't be decided to a subsequent proceeding because it wasn't an issue before the court. The only issue before the court was whether or not there would be an issue of an order of reasonable and necessary and related medical benefits in the event of a finding of compensability. Dr. Keefe
could the claim?
Dr. Keefe couldn't be authorized under the order in this hearing because the court had made a finding by accepting that stipulation that Concentra was authorized. That means that once they've made that finding, respondents haven't waived the right of first selection. Once we haven't waived the right doesn't pass to claimant. So he's ignored the stipulation that Concentra was authorized in order to get to this fiction.
I'm asking my question for you. Let me just start over. Let's say I agree with everything you said about stipulations, Concentra being authorized. Does that mean that Dr. Keefe goes unpaid, or does that mean that your client or your insurer might still be required to pay him if it was determined that his treatment was reasonable and necessary?
We would not be responsible to pay for his treatment if it's unauthorized. But interestingly enough, there was a reason why Ms. Tolbert stipulated to Concentra's treatment. Concentra provided the bulk of the treatment. Claimant would be responsible. Claimant went to Concentra because he was told to go to Concentra. He treated there, and he would be responsible for paying those bills of Concentra if Concentra wasn't the authorized treating physician. Throughout the entire testimony, claimant referred to Concentra as his work comp physician and Dr. Keith as his personal doctor.
Okay, the bottom line is the stipulation absolves you of any responsibility for paying Dr. Keith, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Then the court, on its own accord, decides that 843.404 provided them required us to have designated two providers. Well, the designation is irrelevant under that statute. That designation, once we've stipulated that the doctor is Concentra, we don't care about whether or not we've offered two doctors because the parties have agreed that the doctor is authorized. So that statute should never have been raised. It wasn't part of the record. It wasn't part of the issues for the hearing. And that statutory requirement doesn't impact on the question of whether the employer designated a physician. Rather, it impacts on how the claimant can change physicians. The claimant can change physicians many different ways. He can request that it be changed. He can get a court order. He can, we can voluntarily designate. But right now, we had the right of first selection, and we designated Concentra, and the opposing counsel agreed. I'll save my time.
Thank May it please the court, I would first like to address the issue of compensability in this claim. As Respondent's counsel has gone over, I believe there is an ambiguous set of facts in this claim. It's quite possible that a reasonable person could draw different inferences from the same set of facts that we have here, which is, you know, the very reason that we have a fact finder in the form of an ALJ is to make an inference from these facts. And that's why I believe in this case, what is crucial is the standard of review by which the decision of the ALJ is reviewed. And as well, the court knows, I'm sure, it's substantial evidence. The evidence must be looked at in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. And if two plausible inferences can be drawn from those same facts, the decision of the ALJ must be upheld. And in this case, I think there are several facts that are very important in this case. First, I believe that the fact that you have two pieces of equipment from the same person that land in not only in different spots, but in very different spots. You have a hard hat that's 5 feet away from the claimant. You have a radio that's 10 feet away from the claimant. That fact at least supports an inference that you know, the claimant fell from height. It doesn't have to be the only inference that supports, but it does support that inference. I think another crucial fact in this case is the fact that when claimant regained consciousness, his vest and his lunchbox were still on his roller. The whole purpose of him driving his roller towards his automobile was to place his vest and his lunchbox in his automobile.
Is that in the record, the fact that the lunchbox and vest were still left on the roller?
That is, the claimant testified to that. I can give you a cite. It's on page 17 of the transcript that I have. I can give you a line number if you'd like it. Another operative fact here, I believe, when claimant regains consciousness, when he has time to get his wits about him, if you will, he has pain. He has pain in his mouth. He has pain in the back of his head. It's later reported in the emergency room that claimant has bruising in the back of his head, that he has a concussion. He has some symptoms of post-concussive syndrome. These two facts, to me, support an inference that claimant struck himself, obviously, in two different places. Struck himself in his mouth, struck himself in the back of his head. Again, while these facts may support several inferences, that one of the inferences that they do support is a fall from height, where one is turning. Moving forward, these, again, there are certainly several inferences that these facts could support. But what's operative here and is that the inference made by the ALJ is one of those inferences. There are facts to support the inference that the ALJ has made in his ruling. And that's, as far as whether or not to uphold the ALJ's decision, that's what's important. His decision must be supported by facts and evidence. And that brings me somewhat to my next, what I'd like to address next, and that's Finn. Finn is a case in which there are very few facts. The claimant in Finn wakes up, he has bruising on his forearms, he has, you know, various injuries to his head. But aside from that, there's very, very little evidence of how it occurred. I mean, we don't have the same evidence in that case that we have here. We don't have a claimant who has gone to take things off of his off of a roller that have never made it off the roller, implying that at least consciously he never made it off the roller. We don't have even evidence so much as the placement of claimant's hard hat and the placement of claimant's the placement of claimant's radio after the fall. We don't even have that evidence in Finn. There's very, very little evidence in Finn. I believe that, again, while the evidence in the instant case is somewhat ambiguous, there is evidence here that did not exist in Finn. I think that's the manner in which this the case at bar is distinguishable from Finn. I would also I'd like to address now the designation of an authorized treating physician.
Ask you one question before you do.
Yes.
Ms. Treese was taking the position that there was no conflicting evidence that the claimant had walked to his truck and put away his lunchbox and was on his way back to the roller. Is that your understanding?
No, Your Honor. With due respect to Ms. Treese, I think that's a mischaracterization. There is testimony by claimant, again, appearing in the trial transcript at page 17, that he, when he went back on his roller, a more correct characterization of that would be he, if I understand it correctly, he came to on his roller. He doesn't remember any of that, but when he came to on his roller, that his radio and his hard hat, I'm sorry, his radio and his lunchbox remained on the roller, that he found them on the roller when he regained awareness, I guess you would say, and maybe not consciousness. But moving forward to the issue of treating physician, Colorado Revised Statute 843-404-5A-1A states that in all cases of injury, an employer must provide a list of two physicians to an injured worker. I mean, there's no it doesn't distinguish between work injuries and non-work injuries, and I guess there would be no way to do that since that
could be waived if there was a stipulation to a particular counsel, couldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly could. However, I believe that was waived, and I will concede that was waived as of October the 21st when my client was sent to Concentra. However, there's a period between October the 2nd and October the 21st when my client first goes to Concentra that I believe that there existed no authorized provider. I mean, there's evidence that there was a call made to Healthbridge by my client and Mr. Parlett, who was my client's supervisor. There was a conversation between my client and Healthbridge, and there was a physician designated at that point. Now, Mr. Parlett does not remember who the physician is, and although not in testimony at trial and in a medical record from my client's personal physician, there's evidence that my client indicates that he was sent to Dr. Keith.
Let me ask a procedural question as opposed to the evidence. Were you the trial counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, as you understand the record, what did the trial counsel for the claimant do to put Ms. Treese and her clients on notice that this was an issue when your client when trial counsel is simultaneously stipulating that Concentra is the ATP?
Yes, Your Honor. Medical benefits were endorsed as an issue for that hearing. I believe a central argument in the question of medical benefits is going to be, medical bills, unpaid medical bills were endorsed. A central issue in the determination of whether or not medical bills are compensable or should be paid, is going to be who's the authorized provider at the time.
Okay, well, I guess that's the essence of my question. During the hearing, what did claimant's counsel do to put the employer's counsel on notice that there was a dispute as to whether Dr. Keith or Concentra was the ATP?
Well, that comes up at the really at the end of the hearing, and there is some conversation about that. The ALJ asks claimant's counsel whether there is a dispute over medical bills. Claimant's counsel answers, there is a dispute over unpaid medical bills, but then fails to specifically designate any medical bills that have been sent in. It's an interesting exchange.
And also fails to attempt to renege or qualify the stipulation that consensus the ATP. Correct?
You know, I would agree that does not appear anywhere in the trial transcript. I would renew my contention that I would agree that Concentra is the designated physician from the time that my client was sent to Concentra. However, I believe there's a period between the date of injury and between the time that my client was first sent to Concentra that there was no authorized provider.
I appreciate that's your argument based on the facts, but my question, and I apologize if I'm repeating it, is what did claimant's counsel do during the hearing to put employer's counsel on notice that notwithstanding having stipulated that Concentra was the ATP, nevertheless, there was this gap period during which claimant was apparently arguing that there was no ATP or that he was free to go to Dr. Keefe because the employer had not discharged its obligations? I mean, how is the employer and the insurer on notice that issue is in play?
I'm sorry, I feel like I'm repeating myself a bit. Let me just start by saying that claimant's counsel does identify the existence of unpaid medical bills that are at issue. Again, no specific bills are identified at the end of the hearing, but they are identified. I would also say that, in addition, at the conclusion of the hearing, it's decided that post-hearing position statements will be filed. The ALJ presiding over the hearing specifically tells respondents' counsel that they in the post-hearing position statement he would like them to brief the issue of authorized provider.
Okay, at that juncture under workers' comp procedures, could the insurer have asked to reopen the hearing for purposes of putting on additional evidence, such as whatever it may have been that the supervisor told the claimant or whatever HealthBridge may have told the claimant about seeking medical help?
Yes, I believe so. I believe that response counsel could have done that at that juncture in the...
Thank you.
I have to reserve the rest of my.
Oh, you're the appellee. You can use it or lose it, and we are never offended if somebody doesn't use it.
Well, with that, if there are no more questions from the honors, I will lose it, as it were.
Thank you.
A couple important points. One is that the court made no finding that the lunchbox or vest were still on the roller. And as such, that was not persuasive to the judge. And even assuming the lunchbox and vest were still on the roller's only 5 feet tall, you could easily reach and grab them off.
So are you saying that we are limited in assessing the amount of evidence, whether it meets the evidentiary standard, to evidence that the court referenced in its findings?
I believe you are. When we're determining whether or not substantial evidence supports his findings.